Hello and welcome to Android Developers Backstage. I'm Chet Haas from the Developer Relations team.
I'm Romain Guy from the Android Toolkit team.
I'm Tor Norby from the Android Studio team. And we have two more studio engineers today.
I'm Nicolas Rod from the studio team.
I'm John Hofford from the studio team.
We're outnumbered.
Yeah, it's the way it should be.
It's like all tools and toolkit and then me.
Yeah, but Tor's not an engineer and Nicolas...
Barely.
All right, so today we wanted to talk about constraint layout and motion layout. Actually, all the
design... You don't sound sure, Chet. Are you
the
sure?
Design, no. I'm very sure about all the stuff that I don't know. All the design tool changes. A bunch of stuff came out around, was that ADS?
Yeah.
We had a lot of new stuff in ADS. We had a couple of new tools early this year, but ADS, we announced a lot more stuff.
In particular, motion layout editor came out. So people had been able to play with motion layout for a while.
Could we start by explaining, just in case the audience doesn't know, what is constraint layout and what is motion layout?
Well, no. I think we've had both related? Nicolas and John on before, right?
Yeah,
and
we
I
talked think we, about constraint yeah. layout.
Okay, but
so
what is
avid
motion
listeners
layout?
Of this podcast are already experts on this, but what's new is motion layout. And we did several demos, but we've never let people play with it before, and that's changed.
Also, demos don't work very well on the podcast, so yeah. I think that episode was a loser. Okay, so why don't we start from that? If people, let's assume that people know, what's constraint layout?
So basically, constraint layout is a library that you can use in your application to create your screens. The idea is that you build up the screens and in such a way that it will react correctly to dimension changes, different devices, different languages, etc., etc. And there is a very rich vocabulary of capabilities, if you want, that you can do with constraint layout, and talk and maybe say a bit more how it's used in studio, because there's one of the big stuff was to develop both the library and the tools together to get a better end product for the developer.
Yeah, before constraint layout, we had a layout editor. And
did we? Did we really?
We did. It worked really well for linear layout.
Yeah.
Right? So you could sort of drag to reorder your widgets. And we tried to start giving you more fidelity and sort of higher capabilities for doing layouts by building support for relative layout and something called grid layout. And so we're kind of going in this direction, but we were responding downstream from the toolkit team who were building these layout managers. And so the layout managers weren't super capable. And so when John and Nicolas joined the team, they had already started working on a prototype that really were blending the line between what was the editor and what was the library. And of course, when they sort of then merge that into our layout editor, it became much more powerful. And they've sort of not stopped since.
And they've taken over the entire layout editor.
They've taken over, yeah. Yeah, Nicolas is now in charge of the whole thing. Yeah.
So if you're not using constraint layout yet, please do. I think of it as sort of being relative layout done right, or relative layout plus.
And also
which
done
is,
right.
It has similar capabilities that relative layout did in terms of you are positioning things relative to other things, right? I want this to be on the same baseline as this other element. I want this to be below this other element, which is some of what that's all of what relative layout did.
Yeah, I mean, we started with that idea, that we should be at least a superset of a relative layout,
right.
But we expanded tremendously the capabilities of constraint layout over the years, and that's also because it's an actual library, it's an unbundled library, so we can actually iterate on it, release new versions, and that's something we could not do as easily with something like relative
layout.
And
it's not just that, it's also the architecture of constraint layout, because inside there's the inference engine, which is a very, very generic way. Adding new constraints, new capabilities, much easier than in relative layout where everything was ad hoc.
Right, so yeah, there's internally a linear solver that doesn't really matter for the developers, other than the fact that it makes it trivial for us to add new things, and we definitely have done so a lot.
And it sounds cool. I think if you say linear solver, people are like, I don't know what that is, but
that
it must
smart.
Be powerful. and more like things that made general UI design a lot easier, like the ability to align with the vertical and horizontal lines, right? So all of a sudden you could put in, you know, your designer says, okay, everything needs to be aligned on a 16-dip boundary on the left or whatever. You could actually do that, right?
Yeah, that's actually another, you know, key idea with constraint layout is that not everything that you do in constraint layout have to be the views themselves.
Right.
So you have this concept that you could have helpers to let you more easily create your layout. So we have stuff like representing guidelines or things like that, or ways to group stuff together. So, you know, the toolkit of things you can do is not limited to just the basic functionalities. We can provide additional helpers to make it easier in many different ways.
And that is something I think you've added after our original episode on constraint layout. So can you explain, I think you've had guidelines all along, but not the generalized helpers concept. So do you want to talk a bit about helpers?
Yeah, we did have on the first version of our constraint layout, we had this basic concept, but we only applied it to those virtual guidelines. But we expanded that a lot, and now you have this concept of helpers that can take references of widgets and do stuff with them.
So what's an example?
An example. So we have a couple of examples. One is, we have a new helper actually that we recently introduced called Flow that provides a superset of linear layout capabilities mixed with, you know, something like Flexbox layout in one helper. So if you want to use this kind of ways of expressing your UI in constraint layout, now you can do it like that just using the helper. And internally, the helper is going to piggyback on the linear solver, etc., but you don't have to see that. All you need to do is to, you know, create that helper and point it to the widget you want inside it.
Well, and so interestingly, in the UI, you can use that. It looks like a sub-layout, right, when you use a helper, but it's not. It's
So you still get one large single layout container with lots of children, but you can apply a logical linear layout inside it, if you will.
Yeah, and the other thing that is nice is that you can have multiple helpers pointing to the same widget. Which is the real difference between that and conceptually something like a view group.
So give an example of when you would do that.
So for instance, we have another helper that's called group that lets you, and there's another one called layer, that lets you apply for a transform operation, let's say, or visibility. And so you could have those virtual groups that where you say, you know what, I can turn on this group or turn off. And that's irrelevant on how they are located, what they are doing, but you just control the visibility there.
So I remember you talking about constraint groups from the very beginning, but they weren't there
for a long time. It was in the prototypes.
It was in the prototype.
Like it was in your mind from, you know, when they were in your group and just doing the prototype stuff. And I was looking forward to that because that then takes away the necessity, I think, of then I've got the sub-layout for doing linear layout because over here I just want a simple sort of linear structure. But now all of a sudden you've broken out of the flat layout manager that makes everything so easy.
And there's that's something interesting too, where people think, oh, if you are using constraint layout, that means that everything has to be flat. There is no notion of hierarchies anymore.
Yep.
And that actually is not quite correct.
Yeah.
The idea with constraint layout was more like if you have a component and you want to lay out stuff inside that component, really you should only use something like constraint layout. We should have one level. You should not need to have really deeply nested hierarchies of linear layouts just so that you can get the layout that you want. That doesn't mean that for your entire screen, you need a single constraint layout. You know, having this notion of components is useful for organizing your work. So it's totally okay to have, you know, a root layout manager that could or could not be a constraint layout. It's up to you. And containing other components that themselves could can or cannot be a constraint layout.
So is constraint layout fine to use in a recycler view, performance-wise?
Depends what you are doing, right? The thing is that the system is very powerful. So if you do the relatively simple things, there is absolutely zero problem. If you're doing very, very complex stuff, maybe you need to pay attention. But I believe that's a really common problem.
Just like any layout.
It's like any other layout. You're not losing anything special there. The guidance is always, you know, measure your screens in general and to make sure that you are in line with what the experience you want. The thing, though, is that nowadays devices are pretty powerful. There's also been a lot of improvement in the Java virtual machine we're using on Android.
It's not a Java virtual machine. It's an Android runtime.
The Android runtime. A lot of those performance considerations are much less in mind of people, because things tend to work pretty well nowadays, regardless of what you do.
So constraint layout, it's flexible, it's powerful, it's fast, if I hear you correctly. What is motion layout? Is that another layout?
So I'll let John explain, but it really sprung out of this idea that you can separate the way you position your layouts with those constraints, with those rules. And then this idea that, hey, hang on a sec, if we can separate those rules from the view hierarchy, maybe we can just swap those views at runtime to end up with completely different representation of the same screen. And then if we do that, maybe we could do something interesting.
Yeah, we had in alpha 9 of constraint layout, we had a concept of constraint sets, which allowed you to specify the entire layout as a single file or a single Java object.
So the idea there, listeners can understand, instead of putting all your constraints in your layout XML file as attributes, you can move all the constraints to a separate XML file.
Yes, exactly. And we actually saw people using them to animate, right? They would switch between two different constraint sets using begin delayed transition, and you'll get a pretty nice animation. But we decided we wanted to do a lot more in that space. And that's where we started off doing motion layout. And in motion layout, we basically have two constraint sets, and you can have as many as you want. And we have a concept of a transition defined in XML that goes between the two constraint sets.
So it animates between constraint sets.
So rewind a little bit. You talked about begin delay transition. This is where it began, and it basically builds on or uses the same underlying concept as transitions itself, which is you got a before and you got an after, and it's going to animate between the two. And at first, you try to actually use the transitions structure, but it kind of wasn't flexible enough for doing what you wanted to do.
Yeah, one of the things we wanted it to do is be sort of one system that can handle things like drag gestures, swiping, being part of a coordinator layout-like environment where you can go backwards and forwards.
Yep.
And that sort of simpler structure just wouldn't handle that complexity. So that's where we came up.
Is that because the transition manager was more meant for like, hey, start an animation and then forget? Like it was like play.
Yeah, it's fire and forget.
Yeah.
And very useful for that.
Yeah, and I think it's important to emphasize that, right? Like, you can transition from one constraint set to another with motion layout, but what drives the transition can be time, or it can be other things like finger
touch.
Position, touch, any value, I assume.
Yeah, even programmatically, right?
Yeah.
So. And there's much more flexibility. So the other thing that you couldn't get from the existing transition manager was, like, you could provide custom animations, but really it was kind of fire and forget. It was it was something that was going to run between the two endpoints as opposed to the more complex stuff that you fed into that system.
Yeah, basically we had a problem of trying to get an entire system that was comprehensive and had a GUI builder support for it as well. And so having that whole complexity, we needed XML to define it. We needed an entire structure of what steps happen between the two transitions, between the two states. And that's what led to what we see as motion layout right now.
I see this as like a typical engineering solution, which is because of the following things, I'm going to have to rewrite this from scratch.
Well, that's definitely more fun, right?
Yeah. So it's basically just coming up with the reasons to justify what we all wanted to do from the beginning.
Yeah. Well, actually, we started off trying to build it as a sort of plugin into Transition Manager.
Yep. I remember the walls that you hit.
Yeah. And it just became very, very hard.
One of the problems is what you said, Chet, right? Transition Manager. So motion layout knows the end state and the start state because you supply the constraint set. So ahead of time, it can know what the layout will be. It can compute that. Whereas transition manager can only react.
Yep.
So there's a lot of trickery and magic that you explain in blog posts. But it was really a workaround on top of an existing system. It was not designed from the ground up to
and
do this.
And it was also something like, at the time that you were hitting these walls, like, I really wanted to expand the system to handle what you wanted, but it was very difficult to feed in the kind of flexibility that you needed.
Mm. Right. I mean, at the end, it's a sort of lets us go very far with all the complexity that we could possibly want in a single system and build a GUI builder for it.
So you say all, but I can't imagine that you're done.
Well, there's always more you can add. That's just how...
A third dimension.
We are pretty happy where we are right now with Constraint Layout 2. That includes motion layout. By the time you listen to this podcast, we should have released Constraint Layout 2 Beta 4.
All right, the race is on.
and we're really hoping to, kind of wrap that in the next, let's say in a couple of months, because we have a lot on our plate on a lot more stuff. We really essentially want to stop working on Constraint Layout 2 and start working on Constraint Layout 3.
But so motion layout, you mentioned the constraint set. So, but it does more than that. It can animate other things, right? It's not just position and size.
Yeah, the definition of constraint set had already had a few layers in it. So you have the basic constraints, which are fed to the constraint layout engine, and then on top of that, we had the transform, the view transform stuff. So you can actually do like scale X, scale Y, and rotate, that sort of stuff. And then on top of that, we have a general system for handling custom attributes. So very much like a property animator. So you can also do interpolations of color and any sort of custom text spacing, whatever you want.
Yeah, so, and also you sell the system a little short because you have the start state and end state, but you can have keyframes in between.
Yeah, so it's one of the great things is that you can actually directly control the path across the states as it goes from start to end. You might have 10 different like stopping points in the between each of these states, so you can make it go in curves and arcs and any sort of spline shape or linear shape.
So am I understanding it correctly that each constraint set corresponds to like a stable state of the layout, whereas the keyframes are meant for shaping the path between those stable states?
It's like essentially if you go from state A to state B, the transition and the keyframes in that transition will tell you how exactly you go from A to B. And there's a lot of different keyframes that are supported, so we can do stuff in terms of modifying the position, so the path that the elements follow will be impacted by that. But there is much more to keyframes than just that.
Yeah, and you have a states concept, right? Is that one-to-one with constraint sets?
That's correct, yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I was curious, with the introduction of the editor, what else people could do now? So people have been able to play with motion layout for the last, year or something, as you've been going through alphas?
Yeah, about a week. About a year.
About a week. Felt like a week.
I was kind of surprised that people could play with it, because to me, the concepts that you have in there, especially when you get into keyframes, are like, I don't know how you do that by hand. Like, I know that many people are doing constraint layout by hand, and you can get most of the way there. Some of the attribute names, the constraint names are quite long, but you can get used to that, and there's code
hashtag
completion.
Code completion.
Yeah. See how I got there eventually, though? But you don't have access to things like helpers, which bottom out in more complex constraints. But you could see that people could do that by hand. But with the motion layout, it seems trickier to do by hand. So what do you think that people should be able to do now with an editor that they simply couldn't, because doing the stuff by hand is
difficult?
So you
mean editor, like, so the motion editor, we call it editor, but it's a graphical environment. But it sounds like you're asking about, hey, the source editor, what can you do?
I was talking about the design tool, not the text editor.
So you can of course do everything by hand in XML. What we found, at least for John and I, we're probably like the more used to that library. At some point, it's just too cumbersome to just do it by hand in XML, even though you can do it.
Haven't we also done so much user faster studies? And we've seen that even though everyone believes they're faster in the XML editor, in studies, it turns out they aren't. You're actually...
Yeah, so we timed them, and then we asked them, do you feel like you are faster with by hand or using the editor? And they say by hand, and the time that we measure shows that no. I believe it's because you feel busy, right? Like you're typing.
I'm super productive.
Right, whereas with the editor, you're not always doing something.
Yeah. Well, I think there is something to be said about doing it just by hand in the XML editor, simply also because you know exactly what you want, and therefore there's less surprises, possibly, specifically if you're not used to the layout editor. And, you know, that I could see where people are very used to XML.
For the layout,
I might feel that it's nicer.
For the layout bits, I can totally see, you know, myself, like I could write it from XML. I prefer to use the visual editor, but yeah, I can write it in XML.
Yeah.
But for animation specifically, especially when you start adding keyframes, if the animations are short, like the dev cycle of, you know, typing random values in XML, trying to guess, oh, did I mean like a rotation of 0.39 or 0.42? Whereas in the editor, so something you haven't mentioned is that, you know, there's a timeline and I can scrub the timeline. So I can like precisely advance my animation frame by frame. I can stop at any point. I can go back. I can forward.
And that's definitely like the, I think with animation, you reach a threshold where using the visual editor for it is so much more efficient than doing it by hand that, you know, you just go with the editor. As you say, like the critical feature is to be able to pre-visualize the animation and more importantly to scrub it, you know, so that you can have a better feel on what it does. But we also have this really cool visual representation of the different states, and you can thus instantly switch between states, and that makes it a very compelling proposition.
Yeah, one of the things that people sometimes get confused. They think about just what two constraint sets and you're moving between the two of them. But in practice, what happens is you end up with four, five, six different constraint sets, all representing different states of your application UI. And keeping that in your head and which one you're editing and which transition between which becomes too difficult. And it's just a lot faster.
And on top of that, there are some features that are part of motion layout and the editor that honestly I find difficult to use without visual aids. I'm thinking of cycles, for instance. I'm sure if I asked John what are cycles? And if you use the word oscillator, it doesn't count.
So cycles, there's a case where you want to make something sort of move up and down or blink or flash or in any way shake on the screen. And doing it with a bunch of keyframes would be just way too complicated. And it's very difficult to get the smooth motions you want.
Oh, I've done that in Keynote many, many times for presentations. And it's very annoying.
So what Cycles allows you to do is sort of shape an envelope and frequency of a oscillation.
See, I knew you said
oscillation, not oscillator. Yeah. So
you had me right up until the second half of that last sentence.
So, you know, just imagine a waveform, like if you've ever seen a sound wave on a chart, the waveform kind of has an overall shape and scale, like the amplitude, and then it has the frequency. So this sort of separates the two of them and then puts them in the same model as a keyframe. So at every keyframe, you can specify what the amplitude and frequency is. And then it interpolates all of that for you in such a way that you produce one smooth, continuous motion.
Yeah, almost sounds like procedural animation.
Yes, it's pretty much the same basic concept.
So I don't think I fully understood that.
I was going to summarize that by saying it's complicated.
Well, use the editor.
Let's try it. I want to try to understand it. So, okay. So let's say we have something that's going to move from A to B. And out of the box, is this going to be a very straight line, very boring? Yeah. And I could add a bunch of keyframes to sort of make it move a little. But it sounds like you're saying I can very easily just sort of apply one of these cycles to it, where I can sort of give it a spin or an oscillation or a vibration or whatever you want to call it that just makes the motion more interesting. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's exactly what you can do. But again, this is when you have this particular class of motion that, you know, if you want to have something that vibrates, you know, that oscillates like that, then use a cycle that will, you could do it manually by position keyframes, but that would be a lot of keyframes to do. Right?
Yeah, so just to be clear again, what you're doing is not setting up some sort of shape for the entire motion. It's just a small segment of motion that you're going to repeat over and over. So I'm just saying, hey, move a little to the left, move a little to the right, move a little forward and backwards.
And keep in mind that it applies to any type of attribute. So if you want, for example, a color to pulsate, you could do it with a cycle as well. It doesn't have to be only position.
Yeah. Like a cycle in alpha would be sort of like a blink.
So can I just say I want like a sine curve, for example, and then it's going to just do that with a color?
Yes, yes. Okay. You'd be able to sign square waves, ramps.
It's out of the box. It's very easy to start, and then you could tweak as much as you want. Yeah.
So one of the big things about the editor is that you actually see those curves on the screen as a graph. So you actually can visualize what those changes are implying to your system.
And more importantly, when you change the curve, you can play the animation right there and see what it does.
So can I ask about capability? One of the things that gets tricky in at least some of the UI systems I've worked on is interruption of animation. So you're going, let's say you have three states that the UI can be in, A and B and C. Going from A to C, does the following thing, going from A to B, all that. But what if you're going from A to B and then halfway there, the user clicks a button that takes it to C? And how do you do that in a smooth way? The physics animations library that we came out with is one approach to that, right? It automatically sort of resets the target and does the right thing in terms of timing and curves. But this is not that.
Yeah, so what happens in that situation is when you say, please transition to C while you're in the middle of going between A and B, recaptures the state of all the objects at that intermediate point, and then essentially synthetically creates an animation between that midpoint and
C. And you also capture the derivatives, like the speed or...
So one of the things it doesn't do right now is capture the derivative.
Right. So there's a discontinuity.
There's a discontinuity in the derivative.
And is this an automated, like, get there in a smooth fashion thing, or do you try to use the keyframe shape of the path that it would have taken?
No, it's on a new transition, basically.
So John, I remember you were talking about wanting to use reflexes for that.
Yeah, so we do use reflexes, and that's a library that is...
Let's first explain what reflexes is.
Okay, so reflexes. So John, Nicolas and I worked on robots for a while. And when you do robot, when you work on robots, you have to make the robots move, right? So it's a similar idea, let's say you have an arm and the arm needs to move from point A to point B. You have a lot of constraints because the different joints of the arm cannot do anything possible, right? They have limited angles and speed and stuff like that. So there are libraries like reflexes that are called motion planners, I believe. Yeah. And what they're going to take you from point A to point B, they're going to hit keyframes, but they might deviate from the path to go faster or to make sure that you don't break the joints, for instance.
Yeah, they have to respect specific constraints. Right. And more importantly, specifically for robotics, you have to be smooth because you don't want to break that very expensive motor.
And so the idea that John had was, hey, that looks a lot like the kind of things that Chet was just talking about. You want to go from A to B, but halfway through you want to go to C. And you want to keep a smooth transition between the current state and the new path.
Yeah.
And the motion planner can solve that.
That to me was a kind of a real surprise. Is it turned out that robotics looks a lot like graphics programming.
Yeah.
In many, many ways.
Yes. Yeah. So essentially, we have to produce something that is continuous in its differential.
Right.
And so there's a motion planning piece that happens internally where we look at different perspective motions and see which one fits all the constraints. And there's always one that will fit the constraints. And then we hop onto that motion. But in the current system, we only do that in one dimension. So you get smooth transitions in that dimension that you're going in. But where you're not going to be smooth is when you jump from one transition to another. The angle of rotation, it does not arc yet. That's one of those advanced features that we would love to build.
So when you said you're basically done, I knew that you weren't.
Well,
there's always more.
We also
by the time we release this podcast.
So Constraint Layout 3 will be built like a robot, so technically it will be Skynet.
Maybe.
Right?
We'll edit this out in post.
Okay.
But at the bottom line, because a lot of that is kind of like fancy words and math, but the end result is that the animations with motion layout feel smooth. And that means that even if the user is the one, basically driving the animation with a flick or just dragging the finger and, lifting off, the motion layout engine will then take that and apply rules to do a smooth transition to the end state. And so the end result, I would characterize it, it looks like physics, but you know, it's not. And the big advantage that you do know both states and you know where you end, which is the
difference. So just to be clear, the example of the finger is interesting. So you start dragging something that drives the transition, and then I fling. So you're going to pick up the speed of my fling and transition from the current state of the drag into the animation using the speed, right?
Yes, the velocity of your finger's motion is tracked, and on release, a curve is calculated that will reach the end state continuous in velocity and position.
There's a lot of interesting stuff we can do actually with velocity, and I mean, John mentioned that we do support multi-states, so you can have, you know, the basic is you have two states, you know, start and end, but you can have much more than that. And we actually can carry the velocity when you automatically transition between, you know, multiple states. So let's imagine that you flick, and by flicking you end up on a state that itself has an automatic transition to a third state. We would carry over the velocity.
And if I flick too hard, can I skip a state?
In theory, yes.
So that was a stupid
really
question.
Okay. So, sorry, were you going to say something?
One of the things, we have a lot of depth in the system right now that is such that it's difficult to actually learn the entire system. And one of the reasons why I think it's a good point to stop and release is that it's enough to learn, to feel comfortable that you can build almost anything you're looking for right now. There will be more things in the future that people will want.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, Constraint Layout 1.0 had all the stuff you needed, but you've added so much since.
Well, yes, and part of it is
chains and all that stuff.
And that's also part of why we've been having this model of releasing the library and getting feedback, because a lot of it is in reaction to user feedback. You know, they say, that's great, but, you know, have you thought about adding feature X? And you're like, oh yes, fantastic idea, let's do that.
Well, it's not just user feedback, it's every time you go to a conference, you have
you
to implement
have
a new feature,
new.
Right?
Yes. Well, yes, we are very conference-driven.
So speaking of future stuff, so most of what we wanted to talk about today is stuff that you have delivered, so we could learn more about that. But this topic has come up increasingly. I was at a conference last week, so we were some of us were at Kotlin Conf, and someone said, so excited about motion layout and constraint layout, big fan, can't wait to use the design editor for all this stuff. It's fantastic. In fact, it's so good that new compose thing that you're talking about, I don't want to touch it until it has all of that design stuff baked in. So the question was, so what's the plan?
That's a fantastic question. And I'm sure you answer that person that Constraint Layout is actually checked in a OSP in Ooh-hoo. The Compose branch. So you can use Constraint Layout to create layouts in Compose today using your Kotlin DSL. And we've been, you know, working on bringing motion layout to Compose. The complexity is a little bigger here.
Yeah.
But you know, we have some interesting ideas for the next few months.
So I wanted to actually ask about those complexities a little bit, because what I remember from the early days of working on Compose and talking to your team was, so constraint layout and motion layout by the transitive property are very dependent upon XML, right? Like they work with XML as a resource that, you know, where you record this information through the design editor or not. And that is what it uses as its, you know, transfer protocol between, you know, when you make changes, it stores all that information there. Compose is moving away from resources, right? Everything happens in code.
Right. So there's two things that are actually a little distinct here. One is we have a wealth of concepts to let user describe either their layout, you know, in terms of the rules in constraint layout, or their animation in terms of the rules for motion layout. And the real value of constraint layout and motion layout is to provide the user those concepts, you know, this kind of vocabulary of how you can express those problems, layouts and animation. How we load by default those concepts is through an XML file. You can actually do it in code as well, even today, even in the current version of constraint layout.
Yeah.
It's just that, you know, it's for us, it's better to have it in XML because it makes building tooling and graphical tooling a lot more, you know, straightforward.
Okay.
But even to this day, in motion layout, you can build an entire motion layout and animate it purely in code in Java if you want.
Right, but I think it was the design tool aspects that makes XML a convenient format, right? Because now you have this thing that you can hand edit it if you want. You can use the design tool. You can go back and forth. Because and at the point where it becomes all code, that is much harder.
Because the alternative, would be to basically write an interpreter for Kotlin.
And I remember, some of the tooling stuff that you and I had worked on like years ago in a different reality tried to do sort of code in and out, and it just doesn't really work very well, right? Once somebody goes in and writes some funky loop right in the middle of something that you emitted from your design tool.
Yeah, and I've seen IDEs use code as the, instead of XML, but what they would do, I think it was NetBeans that did that, right? Yeah. Like you would put special comments around a block of code that block of code would be read-only. But it was read-only only in that IDE, so you could still go change the code with any editor.
There's been many different solutions to this. So that was NetBeans. We're basically read-only regions. I think there was an Eclipse UI builder, actually, that came out from Google that we used early on in the Android days, its inspiration. And they would actually try to execute the code. But sometimes you'd make a small edit and suddenly the IDE the editor would just basically give up saying, I can't understand this code.
And I think
we actually struggle with this problem right now in Android Studio because, of course, our build system has this property. It is a Turing complete language, Groovy. Right. And how do we figure out, what your build file is doing and how do we let you edit it? And so we have all these heuristics, but it is fundamentally impossible. You can do certain things to totally trick the tooling.
Well, especially for the UI, because the UI is going to be fed data and that data can be arbitrary object and you have no idea like what is valid, what's not valid, what kind of data to expect. Will the list have one element, 10,000 elements?
Yeah. So what you see in Android Studio 4.0 today with the preview for Compose, it's quite a bit slower than what you see with our XML editor, which is basically instant because we can just re-inflate your XML layout continuously. You make an edit, we re-inflate it. With Compose, we actually have to recompile the code there's certain shortcuts we can take, but generally we will recompile the code.
And also the Compose preview works around this issue of how do you feed data to the UI by you write a special composable function that you mark as a preview.
Yeah.
And your job is by doing that, you can build, it's kind of like almost a unit test, right? Like you can build the mock data that you want to see in that preview. So you decide what shows up.
Yeah, and you're highly encouraged to sort of have separation of, view from data. Right, so you're not going to start putting. Hopefully, you're not going to start putting your activity and database calls into
the goal
your widgets.
Is to hard-code.
You're just going to make a nice view that takes some data from somewhere else.
Yeah, you hard code some data for the purpose of preview.
Yeah.
But you get to choose what it is instead of letting the idea trying to guess.
Yeah. So we said that we have a version of constraint layout, in AOSP already and motion layout on the way. We should clarify that is for people who are writing code by hand.
Yeah. Right. And so that's
what
also
about layout editor and motion editor?
Right. So that's why I was trying to make a distinction between the concept that we implemented on how you can express whatever you want in constraint layout or motion layout. And the XML, right? The XML has a lot of nice attributes, particularly from a tooling perspective, because it's static, which means that we can instantly execute it, etc., etc. It makes it modifying this XML trivial from a tooling perspective. If we suddenly talk about doing the same thing in code, as you just explained, that's a whole different ballgame. So the constraint layout in Compose right now, those rules are just generated via a Kotlin DSL. Right, so it's all in code. So you have all the advantages of a Kotlin DSL. You can even do stuff in functions, etc., etc. But you have the disadvantage of it being in Kotlin in code, which means that we don't have right now a UI builder for it.
Yeah, so people who write XML by hand today, they'll feel very comfortable with this because it's basically "quote unquote" the same thing except in a Kotlin DSL.
Actually, I would say the Kotlin DSL is better because one of the difficulties in the early days of constraint layout we were limited by what XML lets you express, and that's why some of the constraints have ridiculously long names and some of the constraints seem complicated at first, and it's because everything has to be an attribute in XML
and that turns everything into a string. So true and false are just strings, right? And you could pass. And
even references, I don't remember some of them, but or even just width and height, you know, in XML, you have the matched parent, like, you know, wrap content strings, but it can also be a number, so it's just not really typed.
And definitely, like, the, you know, Kotlin DSL lets you write things in a nicer way for the developer, right? So if right now you're using constraint layout by hand, you know, moving to the DSL is going to be straightforward and probably a better experience.
Yeah, and the way, you know, one way to see it's like, I assume eventually, so the tool will just work, like you said, on this separate XML file. And it's kind of like when you load a bitmap or a vector drawable, you have this XML resource that contains information for the UI, and like there's no reason why we couldn't think of layouts that way. Like, you still declare all your widgets in code, but, right, you know, those extra resources, like the constraints, the animations, will come from XML files.
It's a bit like the HTML and CSS separation, right? That in your HTML, you sort of have the actual widgets and attributes on them, but the styling of those things and the positioning is in a separate place, well, ideally in a separate place in a CSS file.
Right. So in an ideal world, we end up in a position where you can use the UI tools to quickly build something, but then just leave in code the dynamic behavior you're interested in. And that's kind of the general idea, but there is a lot of, you know, details that we need to figure out.
So not done yet, but there's a plan and there's some code checked in. So.
Yes. It's early, right?
All right. So there were also new design tools released, and there's new like layout editor stuff that came out recently.
Yeah, we've been continuously working on improving the layout editor.
Continuous improvement.
Continuous. Well, been done. A while. We've been regularly, each version of Android Studio, the layout editor improved. So if you have not checked the layout editor in a while, please do so. It's definitely much better than a couple of years ago.
Such as?
Faster.
It's much faster. It's more robust. We added more functionalities as well. So we had, John actually added a lot of different tools to build your UI faster. If you'd want to just group a bunch of widgets, turn them into a chain, it's just one click.
Overall, the UI has been polished quite a bit, both visually and interaction.
Yes.
Then we have native layout lib, which gives you much better fidelity with what the platform can do.
Yeah. And so, yeah. Right.
So that one's interesting because what we used to do is we used to emulate the Canvas APIs of Android using Java 2D, which is, you know, what IntelliJ and Android Studio used to render on screen. But, you know, the renderings were not pixel perfect, especially for text.
I mean, pixel perfect is one thing. I mean, we were missing whole blending modes. There are certain shapes we couldn't
draw. They were missing features. Yeah. But even the features that were there, like text will never look exactly the same.
Yeah.
And now we use directly Skia, which is the rendering library on Android on desktop, and do the same.
So we in terms purely of design tools, we added a couple more tools that, you know, like the navigation editor or the resource manager in Android Studio 3.5. And specifically, those two are, the navigation editor lets you edit your navigation graph if you're using the navigation library from Jetpack. So that gives you a really nice graphical way of you know, looking at your different screen and how they transition between them on your application level. And the other one, Resource Manager, lets you see all the different resources you have in your project in a very straightforward way. So instead of having the usual IntelliJ, I've got my, you know, my tree view for my project, you can open the Resource Manager and you see, you know, only the resources in a visual way. And we support a ton of resources in 3.6 and in Android Studio 4.0. We added more resources that we do support. So you can see the different font families and things like that.
And there are interactions between those tools, right? Because if I remember correctly, I can drag an image from the Resource Manager onto the layout editor and create an image view.
And again, like every time we release those tools, the next versions of Studio typically see improvements. And in 4.0, for the Resource Manager, we added a lot of drag and drop capabilities, so that makes it a lot more straightforward and a much more seamless experience. So again, you know, check it out. The real cool stuff, though, is indeed what we announced in Android Studio 4.0, where, you know, in terms of the raw capabilities, the new layout lib native gives you a much more higher quality rendering of your assets, of your layouts. So that's appreciable. It's definitely appreciable for the motion editor that we announced in 4.0 as well, because again, like the layout editor, it's using this new layout lib native, so it's faster, it's more accurate, and that, you know, that participate a lot in motion editor being really useful. We announced the motion editor. We announced also a new a layout inspector that is live, so you can connect to a device, see what the screen looks like directly in studio.
Right.
But much more interestingly, you can introspect. So you can click on an element, see where the different attributes of that element comes from, and you can then navigate to the original file that defined those attributes. And
it's particularly useful for styles and themes.
Yes. Yeah, and so you can modify that and click on apply changes and see it on your device instantly. So that's a very useful tool as well.
Yeah, I mean, this was basically impossible before, yeah. Right? Because something would happen inside the runtime. They did not keep track of the data, right? So you just would end up with some font size, and it'd be up to you to scratch your head and try to figure out how you ended up with that.
That's the key here. It's a new tool, but there was also something done in the platform
to make that possible. Yeah, the platform team added APIs for us to hook into so that we could deliver that. It was not possible with previous version of Android.
So, you need a device running Android 10, right?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah. So an emulator or a device running Android 10.
Yeah.
And then there's a validation view as well.
Yeah. So there's this really useful tool where, you know, you can bring it up and it will show your layout in a bunch of different configuration. So let's imagine that you open the layout editor. You have, I don't know, like your Pixel 5 as your default device for what's shown in the layout editor. You bring up the panel for the validation tool and you get... You can automatically generate what the layout looks like in a variety of configuration.
Didn't we have that feature before?
We did. So,
One of those things where we kill the feature, bring it back so we can launch it.
You know, I talked about this new layout editor we wrote many years ago. That's when Nicholas and John joined the team as well. In that one, we never re-implemented multi-config preview, which is what we called it before. Right, now we're calling it validation.
So it is very interesting because we actually go beyond just the configuration. One thing also is that it's live. So if you modify something in the layout editor, you'll see it, you know, impacting that multi-view representation immediately, which is super convenient. But we also added more things. So, you know, you can visualize with a colorblind simulation mode. So we you know, it's easy, much more easier for you as a developer to see if your UI works for these problems.
I know, Romain, you know, you talked about this back in the day. You wanted us to sort of do glare. You want to simulate different environments. Yeah, you can see if your app looks bad if you're sitting.
I had a prototype using Filament as the rendering engine, where we could bring up the UI on a 3D model of a phone with like the correct glare of the, you know. So what does it look like?
So
in
basically, if you're sitting on the subway, can you still play this game? Because you know there's
And we have a lot more ideas in terms of validation, in terms of, you know, lint checks and surfacing them correctly to the developer, etc., etc.
So to tie all this back to motion layout, I know in the nav editor, it's kind of nice. You can, when you have a transition from one screen to the next, you have certain effects you can apply. So you can say, oh, I want you to do like a little rotation or a crossfade, right? But it's you're kind of limited to these built-in,
some of them are the old view animations,
well,
actually.
Well, it's because, and more importantly, they use the old view animation API, but they're executed by the window manager, which is an entirely different system.
How cool would it be if I had two fragments, and they're both actually constraint layout based or motion layout based? It'd be nice if I could actually pull that up and customize this motion so that if I, for example, have a music playing app and I'm going from like a song list to like, you know, from album list to like a song, and I want to sort of really customize. So instead of a crossfade, I want to take, you know, the album thumbnail and grow that one.
You heard your boss.
What?
Get on it.
Feature request.
Well, I think what I would say is that it would be very cool indeed. the reality is that you can actually do quite a bit of that today. You just have to do it a little by hand. We have a couple of examples we have a GitHub with samples for constraint layout and motion layout, and we have a couple of examples transitioning between fragments. But there's a lot more we could do there.
Yeah, I would just love for us to help with the plumbing, because I think right now the easiest way to do this is to sort of have one big master layout where that's your entire application, sort of in a single layout. But that is not how the nav library works, which is really sort of like, hey, partition your stuff into fragments. And so if we can help bridge that gap in the tooling, that would be kind of fantastic.
And we discussed that quite a lot, John and I, but it's, right now we're in a position where we kind of want to wrap up the 2.0 release because, you know, if we keep adding more stuff, it will never ship.
Yeah.
I think he was actually testing you there to see yes. whether you were like, you know what, great idea. Put the beta on hold. Let's jam on this for a while.
Yeah.
So you passed, but still feature request. Yeah, that would be awesome, actually, because I think that is, it's one of the places where you see the seams between the different architectures of the platform where, well, we had fragments that sort of built on activities and it came from an old world and there are limitations and they do use the window manager and the old animations. And then we have this amazing new system, which is kind of living within its own fragment.
Yeah. Right?
And so, to be clear, I mean, the navigator today still makes it very easy to have a much yeah. smoother experience than if you yeah. were to like just fire your own intents between these fragments.
Yeah.
But it would be nice to take it to the next level.
Yeah. Right. I mean, the problem is with, you know, all the new motion layout stuff, now everybody's going to get used to that richness and then they're going to say, but why isn't it? So,
yeah.
I mean, the overall plan is, you know, we are building each one of those new capabilities, each one of those new features, we're building it on top of what we already built, right? We were able to build motion layout because of constraint layout. We were able to build the motion editor because of motion layout. And we are going to continue like that. So the more we do there, the more we'll be able to improve the developer experience.
Well, cool. Nice note to end on. Do we miss anything here? Anybody? All right. Thanks.
Thanks.